You're listening to The Weather Junkies.
Oh, boy.
Large wedge tornado coming up into Tuscaloosa. A winter storm warning is in effect for our area.
The snow, we can expect at least another 2 to 4 inches overnight. Then that snow is
probably... The National Weather Service in Huntsville has issued a tornado warning for northwestern Madison.
14 to 22 inches of snow!
Good Thursday evening. Thank you for joining us here on The Weather Junkies. I'm Tyler Jankowski, joining the show from a snowy and cold Bristol, Connecticut, alongside Dakota Smith in Colorado. Dakota?
Hey, everyone, and hey, Tyler. Thanks for listening tonight. Yeah, I'm out here in Meade, Colorado, just north of Denver, and we are seeing record heat right now. We'll get into the tweets, but Denver actually saw it's a record high today at 83, and so I am loving the weather out here. I am holding on to the heat and as long as I can because I know winter is right around the corner and it's not going to hold back. But Tyler, you're seeing the exact opposite weather. Tell me a little bit about the situation out there.
Yeah, a storm moving from west to east, coming from Pennsylvania. It ran into some cold air. We had a high pressure system in a pretty good spot for some cold air, and we had the coldest morning so far this season. Yesterday morning, I think we got down to like 32 or something, the coldest we've seen so far this season. And we've really nailed this forecast, at least the threat of snow from several days out. It definitely overperformed, and many people saw accumulations when we didn't think they would. So in that respect, it was not a phenomenal forecast, but the idea of some snow we pinned down a few days ago. I think the highest total in Connecticut is probably going to be around 2.5 inches in the Northwest Hills, but it even snowed and accumulated in Hartford. And I'm seeing some tweets come through right now, and it's close to 5 inches up in the Springfield, Massachusetts area, which is on the valley floor. So pretty impressive. And at Bradley Airport, where our official observations are taken, we have seen between 1 and 2 inches. We'll have to wait and see what the final number is, but it's the third snowiest October on record in the Hartford area. And the really fun fact today is that last season, we didn't see any measurable snow until December 29th. So completely opposite this year.
Yeah, we'll talk about that a little bit more. We have a tweet dedicated to it. But just to your south is our guest tonight, Brian Kahn. He holds a Master in Climate and Society from Columbia University. He previously worked at the International Research Institute for Climate and Society and partnered with climate.gov to produce a variety of media content related to climate science. He's appeared on many sites. His writings appeared on many sites. And right now he is the senior science writer at Climate Central. And fun fact, he led a sled ride tours through herds of 7,000 elk, which I thought was kind of cool. But Brian, thanks for joining us. And how's the weather in New York?
Hey, thanks for having me. It's really disgusting here, actually. I'm looking out my window and it is absolutely pouring rain. So, you know, I think I take the snow in Massachusetts or the sunny weather in Colorado over what I got here right now.
Yeah, the cold rain is probably one of the worst types of weather.
More or less.
Yeah, so we'll be talking with Brian about some of his work at Climate Central, particularly his National Park series in a bit. But let's get into our tweets this week. And I'm going to start it off with the Denver heat record this week. This tweet comes from Chris Spears. You can follow him at ChrisCBS4. He's a local broadcast Met out here. And his tweet says, Denver busts its 50-year-old record high, makes a rare mark in history. They reached 83, and we just barely reached 80 in Fort Collins. So not much to complain about out here. And like I said, I'm holding on to this weather for as long as I can. Tyler, I'm assuming you kind of wish, well, I don't know, you like snow, so.
I like snow, but last week we had 80 on Monday, 84 on Tuesday, and 80 on Wednesday. So it's a quick change. And I had Tuesday and Wednesday off last week, so I savored the warmth. But I don't know. We didn't get a lot of snow last year. This is just a little bit of a little bit of a shock. And the rain, I think, really does me in. The rain, and we need the rain. We're going to get about an inch tonight, hopefully. But I don't know. It's just a very gross situation out there with the snow and the water now making it even worse with the at least how it feels. We need the rain, though. I got to stop complaining.
Yeah, let's actually move on. Let's go to this tweet from Ryan here, which has to do with your weather that you're experiencing out here. This tweet's from Ryan Breton. He's a meteorologist, on-air meteorologist over in New Hampshire. And his tweet says, a high impact few inches of snow from northern Connecticut through western Massachusetts. And he says he doesn't believe anyone accurately predicted this. Is that true, Tyler?
I would agree with him. Sometimes you get caught up in the heat of things and you're so excited as a meteorologist that it's snowing more than you thought. But I think he hits the nail on the head, because when I think back to the forecast, we had the Northwest Hills of Connecticut highlighted for perhaps a slushy accumulation at the beginning, but quickly going over to rain. The reality is that most of northern Connecticut, and certainly up there in Massachusetts, Sturbridge, the tweet he's referencing, is in the valley in western Massachusetts. And I mean, the picture looks like January 15th. The pine trees have thick snow on them. There's probably a couple of inches on the road. There's like a car off the road. So that's definitely not what we expected. We didn't expect the snow to accumulate like that. I mean, I wouldn't consider Sturbridge a hill town, and that's a lot of snow for October 27th. And we really didn't forecast that impact for the road, and it came during the evening commute. So he's right. It was not forecast that way.
Yeah. It's that an area like that can handle a big dump of snow, you know, when it's well forecast and it's in the middle of the winter. But when you get a snowstorm like this, that kind of creeps up on you, and it's the very beginning of the year, it can cause a slew of problems. So it's kind of an interesting thing how that ends up working out.
Our next tweet comes from Vortex Jeff. You can follow him on Twitter at Vortex Jeff. His name is Jeff Frame. And he tweeted an article, a link to the unions, the National Weather Service Employee Union's comments on a recent announcement about a reorganization plan. And his tweet says, article with some details on NWS reorganization plan and union response. And I personally listened to the National Weather Service's press conference live, and I caught a glimpse of what the union said. The union actually released a press statement before the actual public press conference by the Weather Service. But basically, the National Weather Service Employees Organization says that a lot of offices are going to be closed, and they're really concerned about a centralized forecasting office and all kinds of major changes. What I got out of the press conference from the Weather Service, and obviously they're not going to come out and say lots of negatives, so there's a lot of frosting on the cake that you have to scrape off and get to the bottom of things. It was a long-winded press conference that had a lot of information most people fell asleep over. I will say that. They did a nice job glossing over what may not end up being a popular move. But I think the gist of it was they're going to get away from consistent staffing levels, and they're going to move to more of a demand-based model. So for us in the Northeast, New York City, Boston, more staff. But if you're in Nevada or places where there's not a whole lot of weather, you'll have less staff. South Dakota. Places like that where there's not a lot of need, there's not a lot of media, there's not a lot of people, the staff would go down and perhaps be on a more part-time basis. And the other thing that was made clear in the press conference was that you no longer need an office at the radar sites, which obviously we've known that for a long time with the advancements in technology and the internet. You don't have to have a Weather Service office at every radar. So they want to get away from that model. And they also mentioned the possibility of teaming up with emergency managers and perhaps running the local offices out of these bigger buildings that house more than just meteorologists in an effort to better coordinate. From that perspective, I think it's a great idea. I think being housed with other people that, you know, have the power to make decisions, I think that's a great idea. I think the area that they have to be very careful in is too much consolidation and too much downsizing. Don't want to see anyone lose their job. So they have to be careful with how that shakes out.
Tyler, I think you summed this up pretty good here. One of my biggest concerns about this is I'm actually all for automating your weather forecast. Because one of the parts was automating the weather forecast, that it comes from a central location. And I think that's a good idea on like a normal day. You know, it's like a day like today, we didn't need someone to, you know, spend, I don't know, 15 minutes and looking at the temperatures and forecasting a nice sky with 80 degrees. But my concern is that when it comes to these high impact events, that you're not going to have the knowledge to make the best forecast that someone could make, because you haven't been every day looking at models and looking at topography and looking at what happened yesterday and how it compared to your forecast. And so I think there's some reason for concern right there. And there's also, you know, there are many areas for concern. I trust the National Weather Service in that they're going to do this the right way. Louis Giuliani is a very, very intelligent guy, and I believe in his leadership. So there's some reason for concern, but I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt that they're going to do it the right way.
Yeah. Were you commenting on the possibility of like people flying around and covering areas when there's big weather outbreaks?
No. Was that a thing that they said might happen?
I thought I heard that might have been a rumor. Obviously, I'd be against that. But you are right in saying the local knowledge. People always say local knowledge, but I think one way to make that relatable to people is it's tough sometimes to forecast for an area that you don't live in. Like, if I were to forecast for Washington State and I'm in Connecticut, I don't get to feel the air there. I don't get to feel that what it's like outside. And, you know, the Storm Prediction Center would be an obvious counter argument to that because they do a great job and they're based in Oklahoma.
That's a good point.
I think there's something to being where the weather's occurring and actually stepping out and seeing what it's like. And you know, I mean, the Weather Service office in Boston does a phenomenal job communicating with the local people on Twitter, the local, you know, weather fanatics who report observations that are so helpful, and with the people that are on TV and with other forecasters. That would be very hard to maintain if you had people that go all over the country or at least focus on different parts of the country at different times.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. I don't know, Brian, you have any comments on what they're doing over there?
Yeah, anyway, you know, the point you bring up, Tyler, is actually a really interesting one, that these local offices have people that are invested in the local population. And that, you know, that's the kind of engagement that losing that is a big loss, not just for in terms of whether the forecast is good or not, although there's certainly that aspect. But, you know, I mean, that's a big, it's a relationship building process. And to lose that with the spotters, the networks of people that, you know, tune in to Facebook or Twitter to get their information, I mean, that's a big loss in itself. And so I think, you know, it's kind of a tread lightly thing, especially when you think about the landscape of how people get their weather in the 21st century.
Yeah, and that's a good point. And we'll monitor this on our subsequent episodes. And, you know, I think we should probably dedicate an entire episode to this.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Maybe have someone on from the National Weather Service. Maybe have Andy Horvitz on, who was on one of our episodes back in the spring. But for now, let's move on here to our final tweet. And this tweet comes from our good friend Devin Boyer. You can follow him at WXDevin. He's a programmer right now for Weather Underground.
The Weather Company.
The Weather Company, but yeah, I think he does some work with Weather Underground. Anyways, this tweet says, a whiteout watch is now in effect for Beaver Stadium and surrounding parking lots. Go State beat the Buckeyes. And Tyler had to include this one today.
Yes. I mean, we always talk about having too many weather alerts, but the Whiteout Watch. You cannot have a Weather Junkies episode hosted by two Penn Staters and not acknowledge the signature marquee win, biggest in decades, at Beaver Stadium this past Saturday night, knocking off number two, previously unbeaten Ohio State. That's all I have to say.
I think you said it well enough. let's move on here to our main topic tonight, and that's the chat with Brian Kahn here from Climate Central. So, Brian, I'm going to start off with how you got into writing about climate science. What was kind of your path to get here?
That's a good question. It was a very circuitous path. My interest in climate actually really started, I hate to think about how long ago it was at this point, but, 10 years ago or so. I was a big skier and just had this thought one day I was skiing, I was at the top of the mountain. I was like, I wonder what's going to happen if all the snow disappears. And that kind of just got me going on this tangent of climate. And so, got a little more science education just to get the background of it from my master's. And then I've always loved writing and talking with people. And so transitioned from initially I was working with the National Park Service, doing a lot of outreach work, and eventually sort of found my way to Climate Central. And it's been a great chance to talk about climate. For a long time when I was working at the Park Service, it was talking about local climate change. And before Climate Central, I was working at the International Research Institute for Climate and Society. And there's a lot of focus on talking about the international impacts of both climate change and also variability for that matter. And at Climate Central, it's been a really good transition yet again to talk, take this sort of national level view and really talk about what climate change means to folks here in the U.S.
So you started writing, and I think you're still publishing parts of the series, but the series about the national parks, where you had a Q&A with the director, and then you talked about a few select parks, including New York City's Harbor Parks and Glacier National Park, and it looks like you're going to talk about the Everglades in the future. If you haven't checked it out yet, and you're listening right now, go ahead. It's at reports.climatecentral.org/NPS/overview. We'll have it on the site. What inspired you to write this series?
I worked for the Park Service for a handful of summers and then a bit of a longer period in 2010. So I've always had a soft spot for the Park Service. I love being outside. I love hiking. And actually, I think when I started at Climate Central a little over 3 years ago, I pitched my boss. I said, hey, we should do a story about the national parks. We should do a whole series because they're awesome. And there's a lot of climate impacts we talked about. And he kind of put it off. And I'd pester him every few months. And finally, I was like, hey, man, it's the 100th anniversary of the National Park Service. There's literally no better time to do this. And it would make me really happy if you said yes, finally. And he was like, all right, fine. It was just kind of this sort of long-term, knowing that there are a lot of stories to be told, not just about the impacts in parks, but also how the agency was addressing climate change. And it's something that, when I worked for them, I saw a transition from starting in 2006, when it was a pretty lightly discussed or not discussed at all topic, to 2010 when I left, where it was definitely starting to hit the radar and people were talking about more and more, to finally 2016, when it's one of those front and center issues for the centennial for the Park Service to both, look at all the things that have already happened and look at all the work they've done in a number of parks to sort of insulate themselves from climate change, but also looking ahead to the next 100 years and what does the future of conservation look like in these places that are really, in a lot of ways, they're just such a crucial part of the American fabric and how people sort of create their identities for living here in the U.S. These beautiful natural and cultural sites. So, it was just one of those things where I've been deeply obsessed with parks. I've loved them and finally got a little buy-in from my boss, or at least warmed down to publish these stories.
Yeah, well, I share that love for national parks. Living out here in Colorado, it's really easy to get to a whole bunch of them just by driving. And I think this is something that a lot of people, a majority of Americans can relate to, because at some point you go to a national park, whether it's a big park like Yellowstone or one of the smaller ones. How did working there and the knowledge that you had from working there impact how you decided to cover the parks?
Just getting the inside, having had at least some inside information, admittedly slightly dated at the time I started writing these stories, but having a little insights into how the Park Service functioned really helped to know, you know, what kind of people to target to talk to. It gave me a little bit of insight into what parks were ahead of the curve. And then, you know, the Park Service has a whole dedicated climate change response program. And they are this amazing resource within the agency that basically, you know, any park can call them up and say, hey, we want sea level rise projections. We want to know how precipitation will change. You know, what are the next things that are going to happen with our bighorn sheep? And they're there as a resource. And so early on in the story writing process, I hooked up with them, and it was just unreal to be able to call up someone at that office and say, hey, who do you know at the New York Harbor Parks? And they'd say, well, you know, here's this person that you should talk to. And then that person said, here's someone else you should talk to. And, you know, for me, it was kind of nice to have that. It was nice to have those ins, and then, you know, understanding how they're structured and the things that people are dealing with there sort of gave me, I guess, a little bit of inside track and street cred, hopefully with my sources. So they were able to open up and talk about some of the more in-depth stuff that they maybe would glaze over if it wasn't someone that didn't understand the process.
You know, when I first heard about the series, I instantly just thought about Glacier National Park or how the ecosystems are going to change. But I never thought about warmer weather equals more visitors. And it looks like that's actually a big deal for a lot of parks. I was wondering if you could talk about what kind of problems have been arising because of that and what types of things parks are doing to adapt to that.
Yeah, that was one of the things that caught me by surprise too. And they actually had the National Park Service did a study on this exact question of what weather, you know, climate change and warmer weather would mean, and found that in the majority of their parks, their visitorship increased, with the exception of really hot places like Saguaro in Arizona or Death Valley in California. And, you know, more people in parks in theory and in practice is a great thing because it means hopefully more people have positive experiences, they want to protect them, and it, you know, sort of builds this bigger group of stewards in the 21st century. Unfortunately, it also comes with a downside that for a lot of these parks, what they'll see is an increase in the shoulder seasons. And so spring and fall, and for most parks, I mean, they beef up their staff in the summer to address when visitors are mostly there. And then in the spring and fall, they kind of cut back a little bit. And that's how their budgets have functioned for decades and decades. And so on the one hand, this is a big, you know, sort of budget issue or question that needs to be solved, is how do you account for more people showing up right when you're expecting to have less staff on hand to welcome them? And then, you know, the other side of it is just it's an infrastructure issue. The superintendent at Glacier and I had a conversation about what happened there. They had a really warm, I guess it was March or April a couple years ago, and just had people showing up and pitching tents, and they had no bathrooms open, so people kicked open the doors and made use of the bathrooms. I mean, and, you know, if you got to use a bathroom, you got to use a bathroom. But it just was a thing for him. It was like, this is it. We're living this right now. We have to decide, and we have to figure out how we're going to address our visitors' needs, because you don't want to turn people away, but you also have to be able to make sure that you provide them with an experience that will hopefully, you know, provide that lasting positive memory for them. So I think that that's one of the biggest questions for the Park Service, is how do you accommodate more people showing up at odd times of the year?
So you mentioned Glacier National Park. I was lucky enough to visit there, and you mentioned that some of the glaciers are coming to an end, and at least projections have it that they some of them might be gone by a certain date, a few decades in the future. It's kind of on the opposite spectrum. Is there any worries that some of these parks might see less attendance because of how the ecosystems are impacted?
That's a great question. And, you know, from what I remember reading through this study, there are very few parks that will see a decrease in visitors. The top of my head, you know, I remember seeing a couple like that were going to contract a little bit, but on the whole, I mean, it is really looking across the board, like most of the parks, you know, 410, 11 now, there've been a lot of parks out this summer, but you know, they're all going to see for the most part, either minor or in some cases, major increases in visitors.
I haven't read the study, but I'm curious if it includes impacts from ecosystem loss.
Yeah, and that's a good, I mean, that's sort of like, that's the great question of climate. It's like, all right, well, you know, we know this first level order impact of temperature will bring more people, but then, yeah, if you lose the things that people care about when they go to those parks, does that change your visitation? Does it change where people go in the parks? I mean, there's a lot of second level things that I think will be interesting questions to be answered in the coming decades, not just for parks, but for any place in the US for that matter, any place in the world.
Yeah, and it seems like it has the National Parks Administration attention, and that they're doing a lot to make sure they handle this the right way. So that's really good to hear.
Yeah, they've been really lucky. I mean, Jonathan Jarvis, who's the director of the National Park Service, is, by all accounts from the people I talked with, both, you know, within the Park Service and even outside of it, with agencies that are with nonprofits, NGOs that are familiar with his work, have really spoken highly of his ability to champion climate change in parks and take on what is obviously a contentious political topic and make it part of the Park Service's central organizing mission for how they look into the future. So, you know, it's a sort of hopeful story that here's this federal agency that's able to, despite potential partisan gridlock around climate, actually get stuff done.
I have a question. Can you give us a few prominent examples for people that have not yet seen your stuff of how the parks have changed as a direct result of climate change so far?
Yeah, I mean, you know, so glaciers are, you know, point in case, like number one, that's the biggest visual impact you can possibly imagine. You know, and that's something happening across the entire system. So you're seeing glaciers disappear in Glacier, as well as across Alaska and even, you know, other high parks, you know, parks that have highlands all over the place. So, you know, Grand Teton, Yellowstone, you name it, ice is definitely going to be a thing of the past. In those parks, some of them, particularly in the lower 48, a lot sooner than later. You know, beyond that, I mean, you're also looking at, you know, other impacts from sort of just a weather standpoint. Well, I shouldn't say, well, we'll say, first we'll say, you know, silver rise is another big thing. In Everglades, silver rise is basically turning coastal forests into dead zones. And in other places like Fort Jefferson, which is a park, it's Dry Tortugas National Park, which is located in the Florida Keys, you know, they're actively considering at some point having to let that park, let it go in some ways, to let the structures that are down there sort of be swallowed by the sea, because they're already seeing impacts from silver rise and flooding on a much more regular basis. But then you get those climate impacts and overlay them with weather. And so the Harbor Parks is a really, to me, potent example from Sandy 4 years ago. You know, the Statue of Liberty and Ellis Island were basically completely inundated. And in the process, you know, they learned a lot of things, which was that you probably shouldn't put your equipment in the basement if you needed to operate your park. And so for Ellis Island, you know, everything you would need to run that park, from heating and cooling to telephones to electricity, was all in the basement. And even though it's not the most like sexy thing, the coolest thing that I saw there was they took me behind the scenes. And now all of their equipment is raised onto a second story steel platform to basically be spared from future inundations. And so to me, that's like, you know, you see the impact and then you see this response. And so, you know, seeing that was like I said, it's not like the sexy, huge adaptation project, like building a ring around Manhattan or anything like that. But it's like these little things that are actually going to make a big difference to preserve these places in the future.
And I have one for you.
The trees in California.
What's that?
The redwood trees.
Oh yeah. I mean, so redwoods, it's a really complex thing. They have a lot of, you know, they rely on fog. And so what happens with the coastal fog there is really, you know, it's an active area of research. And so I know that they're very much interested in basically making sure or understanding what will happen and if certain areas will lose trees, if they may grow in other places. You know, the other big tree in California is the sequoia, and same thing there. I mean, they're really curious about what happens with fire in those forests in the Sierra Nevadas. And if you get, you know, those trees are used to low level, just sort of like minor fires every couple of years. And, you know, with the potential of hotter, more intense fires in the future, those trees could be forced to either, you know, they could get burned out or they could be forced to move up slopes. So there's a lot of, you know, these are like the big questions, like in, but those iconic species, it's like, how do you plan to protect them? Do you help migrate them to certain places, or do you just sort of let nature, or sort of this unnatural nature, take its course? And there's, you know, there's no straightforward answer to that, which I think is going to be one of those big challenges that the Park Service has to address, you know, coming up with an answer and what is in some cases maybe the best, but in some cases maybe an unsatisfactory answer for how they plan for that.
I was going to say, Tyler, I went to Kenai Fjords National Park in Alaska, and there's a very, very famous glacier, Exit Glacier, that actually President Obama took a tour of. And there's this path that you go on to go up to it. And I was there with my girlfriend, and we were walking, and we see a sign as we're driving in with a number, and it was like, I don't know, like 1895. And at first we're like, what the heck does that mean? And then we see another one, 1904, and then we keep seeing them. And by the third sign, we're like, oh my gosh, that's where the glacier was at that date. And I guess that's where that's where the glacier, it peaks, I guess, in the winter. And so that's, you know, one kind of glaring, prominent, change from global warming. And yeah, that glacier continues to retreat, every year. And luckily you can still go up to it, and they've been building more trails but that's just one that I noticed when I was over there. So we talked about a lot of what you've done, Brian. What can we look forward in the future from this series?
Well, definitely have one that's in the books right now, or in the works, I guess I should say, about climate communication in parks. And yeah, I'm really excited about that just because I've worked on that for a couple of years, so it's really near and dear to my heart. And got a chance to talk with somebody that I worked with for a couple of years as well about his efforts. He's really this cool ranger named Brian Atlane who works at Crater Lake. He's a, you know, climate reality trained speaker, and I guess he's also a trained trainer for that matter, and is really engaged on climate. And you know, his work was really inspirational to me. And so getting to talk with him about how he thinks about climate change and talking with people about it in parks was really interesting. And I mean, in some ways, there's no better place to talk about, you know, climate change than in these parks. In part, you know, the way I used to approach it was like, I don't want to ruin people's vacations. And then eventually had this sort of turnaround of being like, well, you know, this like climate change thing might actually permanently ruin their vacations if they come back here in 10 or 20 years and everything looks different. And so, you know, talking with him and talking with other folks that have done research on climate communication in parks, you know, it's pretty clear that they're actually really powerful places. People are open and receptive to hearing about what's happening to these places. And I think a big part of that is because you can point to, you know, the glacier disappearing, right? Or you can show where a big fire or a bark beetle infestation did in a forest. And so, you know, that's the story I'm really excited about to get out there. And hopefully, you know, if my editor's listening, hopefully he'll get to some edits and we'll get that out there sooner than later. Cause yeah, I think it's a neat piece. And I think it's really important for the general public to realize that, hey, we can learn about some science in our vacations. And also for, you know, rangers and other folks to, if they don't have that courage to talk about it, that they can get the courage and see that this is not a bad thing to be doing. I'm talking about climate and parks.
Well, we look forward to your future publications there. You can find it on climatecentral.org. And something that I saw that you wrote outside of parks was this write-up about you interviewed a bunch of, I guess, young climate scientists, people that are relatively new to the game. And you asked them, like, what it was like, and you asked them all these questions, and how do you handle... my favorite question was how are you handling the future of climate change? And someone responded, whiskey. I was curious how you got the motivation to write that, because I really enjoyed it. It was funny at the same time as it was you know, very interesting.
Cool. I'm glad to hear that. And you know, for me, that's actually a story that I've been thinking about for a while. It just seemed to always get pushed to the back burner for whatever reason. There was no good like news peg to tie it to. And finally just was like, get into it. It's time to write this story. Let's make it happen. And the big reason that, you know, I was excited to do these kinds of Q&As is I feel like you hear from, there's nothing wrong with hearing from established voices in the field a lot in the news. They tend to be very well informed and say interesting things and all that, and their opinions really do matter. And so it's always nice to me to quote like a Michael Mann or a Gavin Schmidt or a big name climate scientist in a piece, like, because I know I'm sort of getting the real McCoy. They'll, you know, tell whatever it is like it is, basically. But I think that it's really important to highlight new voices and people that are you know, going to be the next generation of great scientists in the field, their perspective is really valuable. And honestly, I mean, it's such a, to me, I mean, coming into climate writing comparatively recently, like I still kind of, you know, I trip on it a little bit. I'm like, oh my gosh, like I'm writing about this big, huge thing, like this big global problem that we kind of need to solve in the near future, or else things are going to be kind of ugly in the not so, you know, distant future. And so, you know, from my perspective as a journalist, I've definitely gotten a lot of insights into climate science, but scientists obviously have like the insight. They spend their entire lives studying this. And so I was really interested to hear from people that are really at the beginning of this journey of their careers to, you know, get a sense of why they got into climate change in the first place and, you know, what they really, what keeps them going on such a sometimes heavy topic. So I was hoping it was like, you know, I'd get a little bit of like the, I figured I'd hear a little bit of like the, yeah, it's really hard, but it was really nice to hear some of the hopeful things that they had to say. And, you know, if not, I guess there's always whiskey. So that's one way to keep getting through if you need to.
Yeah, I find it, I found it pretty motivating as I'm doing some research on the carbon cycle. I asked this question to Andrea Thompson, who was on our show. I think it was back in the summer, and I was curious how you decide how you make the differentiation to talk about a weather event and a climate change kind of narrative as compared to just a weather narrative, because it's, you know, we don't have research studies that come out instantly after a storm, but you can also attribute a lot of things to climate change pretty quickly, like heat waves, for instance. That's a pretty obvious one. So I'm curious how you find that delicate balance when you write about events like that.
Well, I mean, you know, some of it is like, like heat waves, like you mentioned, is a really good example where there's a really solid grounding of, you know, increasingly seeing heat waves attributed to climate change. It's, you know, looking at it as a general abstract thing, but then when they've done these, you know, weather attribution events after the fact, you know, that's just one of the most telltale signs of climate change and when it comes to weather events. So, you know, that's I don't want to say it's an easy one, but that's something where we can be like, all right, like there's a lot of stuff to back this up. And so if we approach this tactfully and say, you know, hey, immediately as it's happening, like we can't attribute this in real time, but we can definitely say that this is in line with trends. That's certainly one way, I guess, to provide that context without going overboard into total hyperbole. You know, with other events, it's maybe a little trickier, but you know, certain things like on the whole scheme of things, like extreme rain events are increasing. That's pretty well established. You know, tornado outbreaks, not as solid though. So when we talk about tornado outbreak and climate change, I mean, we actively talk about the fact that there are still things that need to be, there's still research going on that front. And it's still, you know, going to be years before we start doing tornado and climate attribution research, if that even ever happens. So I think that, you know, for us, it's just a question of looking at the event, understanding the magnitude, the type of event, and then, you know, basically looking at the research that's already out there and what we can say definitively about trends. And also just, you know, like I said, being honest about the things that we don't know. It's not like scientists know everything in any field, let alone climate. And so acknowledging that there are still areas of research is totally okay. The other thing that I guess kind of benefits us at we have in-house is we do have a team that we've been working with on extreme weather attribution. And while they're not doing attribution, you know, as an event is necessarily ongoing, they are doing it within, you know, a couple weeks to maybe a month after the events are over. And so that, you know, that group, I mean, part of their goal is to basically make this part of the news cycle that you can talk about what's happening, you know, not a year later when the big report comes out. But when it's like, when it's still kind of on people's minds. And there's a lot of, I mean, you know, that said, like we do this attribution stuff, the science, the techniques they use are very well established, but it's not peer reviewed when it does come out, even though the techniques have been through peer review, the specific findings aren't. And we've definitely gotten pushback from certain people on it. And that's, I mean, I think that that's part of the process. It's a very cutting edge field in science. And so to me, it's been interesting to watch the work that our attribution team does, and then to also see the response from the public as well as, you know, informed scientists on Twitter and elsewhere kind of give you us feedback in real time too. So it's a whole, you know, it's kind of this brave new world that we're diving into.
So you've been with Climate Central for 2 years this month. Over those 2 years, what has the reaction been like to the work that you've done, the articles that you've written for Climate Central, and has anything surprised you?
Let's see. That's a good question. I mean, everyone loves them, obviously. Just kidding. People, you know, I've gotten, there are a couple articles that stand out as like particularly notable for both good and bad reasons. Like, you know, this young climate scientist piece got a lot of positive feedback, both from, you know, public things and people sending stuff on Twitter, as well as sort of behind the scenes and getting emails about it. And that, you know, when I get emails, I'm like, well, that's like, someone actually took the time to find my email address and say like, good job. Like, that's awesome. The flip side of that is that, you know, earlier this year when there were big fires in Alberta, and we wrote a piece about the wildfires and, you know, did not say this is definitely tied to climate change, just said, hey, you know, here's what the trends look like in boreal forests and all that. And we published that while the fires were still burning. And man, I have never received as many nasty emails and tweets and like notes. It was like that one article, I feel like, trumped all the other articles I've ever written in terms of like the negative feedback I got. I also got positive feedback, but it was amazing to see the amount of, I guess, negativity that came out of that. And it was an interesting process. You know, I talked with, we have a couple of social scientists here on staff that look at climate communication, but with across Climate Central's programs. And you know, I sort of brought it up to them. I was like, what do you think happened here? And they said, well, you know, did you notice any patterns? Were there certain things people were saying, anything that really stood out? And you know, I was like, well, you know, that you mentioned it, like most of the feedback I got was from people in Canada, and everyone thinks, I guess, Canadians are really nice, but I guess they're maybe not always nice. So they said, well, you know, I mean, when you publish the article, think about it, you know, that is still like a fresh scar. And when you're talking about these fires that were happening in places where they're mining tar sands, even though we didn't say, hey, like, mining tar sands is the reason this happened, and like, you guys are bad. And not that I think that, because I don't think that, by any stretch of the imagination. But they're like, you know, maybe that's part of what happened there. And so is there something that I can take away to learn in the future? Like, should I, when events like that are happening, should we handle them more delicately? If they're happening in areas where, you know, there is this kind of weird dichotomy of this might have, you know, some climate ties, but the industry there is based on fossil fuels. I mean, you know, should we handle that with more care or step around it? Like, maybe, or maybe not. Maybe it's important to write those things. These are kind of like, sorry, this is my personal rumination. I went through a lot of like soul searching after that piece got published. But yeah, we've gotten some interesting, I think, you know, it's interesting to see the reactions that pieces in general get. I know, you know, one way or the other, if it's a good or a bad reaction, I'm like, well, at least people are reading it and getting them to think. And to me, I mean, when it comes to writing about climate, that in some ways is the most important part, is just getting people to actually think about an issue that's not always on the top of everyone's, you know, concerns list.
I appreciate that you have this kind of very open-mindedness when it comes to criticism and positive feedback. I'm curious what, so you graduated with the master's from Climate and Society from Columbia. What is that program like? Because it sounds really interesting, and I've seen it. It seems like it's a very popular program. So I guess kind of the general overview of what you learned in that program.
Yeah, I'm totally biased, by the way. I also teach a class now for that program, but it is a good program. I really do believe in it. And just as a little bit of trivia, myself, Eric Holthaus, and Andrew Friedman are all climate writers that graduated from that program. So it's kind of like,
oh, wow.
Yeah, for some reason, it seems to spit out, like, there's only a handful of us, and it seems to have spit out, you know, the three of us for some reason. Andrew and I were actually classmates, so, you know, I know him pretty well.
That's really cool.
Yeah, it is cool. And so if you're interested in being a climate writer, come on over, check it out. But it's basically, it's a program that looks at climate as both a climate change issue and a variability issue. And, you know, more importantly, it puts it in the context of society. So, you know, it looks at the ways that society is influencing the climate, and then in the ways that climate is influencing society, and thinking about, you know, the science stuff, but also, you know, it's a really heavy emphasis on adaptation and risk management, and really thinking about, you know, while the science is really interesting and it's very important, ultimately, you know, if you can't communicate it, and I'm sure, you know, you guys dealing with weather and all that, like, you know this very well, if you can't communicate the science, then it's not really worth anything. It's just, especially with such a, something that is such a, so tied to society, whether it's climate or weather. So yeah, that's basically the gist of it, is thinking about how do we translate all this complex science information into terms and resources that people can actually use, whether it's, you know, President Obama or Ban Ki-moon, or whether it's just someone at their local planning office, you know, in Tuscaloosa, Alabama.
What do you teach there right now?
So I teach a course that's called Applications in Climate and Society. And it's actually, it's not the linchpin. That's probably too, that's pat myself too much on the back. But it's a course that basically is like, you know, I teach it along with another alumni who is actually, if you guys are familiar, I'm going to massacre his last name, so I'll just call him Andrew K, but his Twitter handle is WXPizza. He's a cool dude, loves pizza, loves weather. And does a lot of disaster risk reduction work in developing world. So him and I teach this course. We both graduated from the program. And basically our goal is to give students, you know, you can talk about how you apply climate information to society, make it relevant and all that in the classroom. But him and I have had now, you know, years of experience doing that in the real world. And so our goal is to basically prepare these students to be like, this is how you do it, or at least this is how we've done it. And now you should go do it way better than us because we're sure you're capable of that. So we do that, and we also introduce them to practitioners throughout the field from, you know, a ton of different backgrounds, just to give them a flavor of, you know, what awaits them in the future, whether they want to become climate writers or national development workers, or, you know, we had some groups come in from these IDEO, which is like a crazy creative agency that does, I don't even know, they do everything. They're really fascinating. So we got a chance to bring them in and expose them to both, you know, really traditional backgrounds, but also these kind of off the walls folks that are still dealing with climate.
Sorry, my microphone was muted. So we ask everyone this question here, and that is, what kind of advice would you give to someone up and coming in the field, and in your case, wants to be a climate science writer in the future?
What advice would I give? Don't do it. It's a terrible idea. No, just kidding. It's a great idea. Yeah, I'd say that it's just one of those fields where it, in theory, seems like, you know, on first glance, it looks like a niche field. But, you know, what I've discovered in the years of doing this now is it's kind of an everything field. And so, you know, there's so many different ways to write about climate. It can be, you know, the hard science. It can be these adaptation things. It can be how scientists are turning data into music. I mean, there are so many facets to it. And so, you know, to me, if like, I had never thought, some of the pieces I've written in the past year are things I never imagined writing. You know, I did write about these scientists that turned data into music, and that is just absolutely fascinating to me. And I never would have thought of writing it, you know, when I started doing climate writing all these years ago. And so to me, it's like, if you're thinking about coming to this field, I think what's really important is to know that there are so many amazing stories to be told and so many different to be told. And there are so many different ways to approach them and to approach the issue of climate. So if you're even the least bit interested in climate change, but you have some divergent interest, there is going to be 99 times of 100 a way to tie those things together and make it work as a climate journalist.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for joining us. Great advice. And I think that's our third Climate Central person that we've had on. So we're going down our list here and checking you guys off. So thanks for joining us tonight, Brian.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. It was really nice chatting with you.
And if you're listening to us right now, you can follow us on Twitter at the WX Junkies. We're also on Facebook. You can listen to this podcast on SoundCloud, YouTube, iTunes. And if you're on iTunes, give us a rating or review. Christy Shields and Jennifer Nalen actually gave us a review last week. So thank you very much for giving us a review. Tyler, who can we expect next week?
Next week, we're very excited to toss things up a little bit and get a perspective from a person who handles grass, the turf and groundskeeper from Little League International, Rob Guthrie, will be joining us on the Weather Junkies. Most of you have probably heard of the Little League Baseball World Series in South Williamsport, Pennsylvania. And he controls the fields there, makes sure that they're in tip-top shape. The two most prominent fields, obviously being Howard J. Lamadi and Volunteer Stadiums that you see on ESPN and ABC every summer. So very exciting to get the perspective of a turf grass person and how weather plays in, and we'll have that interview live next week. That'll be Thursday at 8 p.m. But that does it for this Thursday's edition of the Weather Junkies. For Brian, Dakota, and myself, thank you for listening, and we hope you'll join us right back here next week.